reason was that, besides studying and discussing, those families who came to see their children would give them information from all over the country, and this information would come into prison.
Drunk with absolute power, the Shah of Iran gave Savak more leeway to oppress any opposition. No matter how hard political parties struggled, the prospect looked grim. From 1975, Savak stopped releasing political prisoners, even after serving their sentences.
At that time, freedom had no meaning for the political prisoner, even for a person who had finished his term in prison. There are many examples of this case who had finished their terms in prison in 1977, but they were not released from prison.
One week before their release, they would be transferred to Evin Penitentiary, and on their release days, they were forced to sign their detention papers. After serving their time, their families were waiting for them on their release days. They would be counting the days for their release. But not only were they not released on the day, but also they were given a detention paper to sign and held in Evin Penitentiary. What's the significance of Evin? In Evin, there was no visit. The families lost touch with the prisoners again.
In those days, the Shah was the cruelest dictator in the Middle East, and reports on human rights in Iran were disappointing. But since the US didn't put pressure on its Iranian ally, the Shah never admitted the deplorable conditions in his country.
You're saying you do what every country does.
Sure.
If torture is necessary, you torture.
Not the torture in the old sense of torturing people, twisting their arms and doing this and that. But there are intelligent ways of questioning now.
Well, they talk about psychological and physical torture.
Physical, I don't believe.
I talked...
Not anymore. Maybe in the old days, maybe.
I talked just today to a man whom I believe, who told about torture.
He was tortured?
Yes.
And you believe that he was tortured?
Yes.
How many years ago?
Within, I want to be very careful, not yesterday.
Ah, well, maybe. I don't know.
The word has gone out to stop it.
To stop what?
Torture.
But a long time ago, yes.
Until 1976, the Shah was a despot, a ruthless man with everything at his disposal. Above all, the country's wealth. That year, the Republicans in the US stepped down from power. The Shah had spent the country's petrodollars on his favorite candidate, Gerald Ford. But in the end, the young Jimmy Carter, with his slogan of human rights, was sworn in as the new president of the United States.
The human rights must be absolute. But let no one confuse our idealism with weakness. Because we are free, we can never be indifferent to the fate of freedom elsewhere.
در جریان انتخابات ریاست جمهوری امریکا
During the US presidential elections, in order to earn a domestic and international reputation, the Democratic nominee announced his decision over abiding by human rights because his predecessors didn't do that at all. They were Republican, abrasive, belligerent, and suppressive. When they came to power, they asked all the dictators who were US pawns to open political space and improve the image of the US.
The Shah of Iran made a U-turn on political freedom and an attempt to win favor with the new US president. As a result, the Savak's harassment reduced and political activities increased.
قرار شد مجامع بین المللی مثل صلیب سرخ جهانی
It was decided that international organizations like the Red Crescent, Amnesty International, a human rights organization, to visit the country's prisons, the political prisons. The Joint Counter-Sabotage Committee had a torture chamber. They quickly put some shelves in the torture chamber and converted it into a library. They put the books they had taken from us there to tell the international organizations that they had a library in the prison.
With this democratic gesture, the Shah aimed to ameliorate the situation and persuade the White House to sell him arms. Both Carter and the Shah rested assured that with the Savak and the most powerful army in the region, an open political space would never put the regime in danger.
The U.S. Senate had asked the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Cyrus Vance, "Mr. Vance, if political freedom in Iran leads to the downfall of the Shah, you will be held responsible." Vance said that they would abide by human rights as far as U.S. national interests were safe.
In the end, opening a political space rather than diffusing the situation helped the opponents hold demonstrations, deliver speeches, and attack Savak for its crimes on an unprecedented scale.
در هر حال این اتفاق افتاد و وقتی که به قضایای سالهای 56 و اینا رسید.
Anyway, as they faced the events in 1977 and 1978, they found out that they couldn't do anything because they had done anything possible without being successful. They agreed to have an open political space since the US had asked them. They were to hold a free election and form a national government, but in reality, from early 1979, they lost control and could do nothing, although Jimmy Carter called the Shah several times, allowing him to do anything to control the situation, and assured the Shah of his support. In other words, Carter said what Cyrus Vance had said before. The US didn't want the Shah to fall, but to improve the situation a little bit.
These changes improved the situation for political prisoners, and old lags on small charges were released.
Since Savak had lost its support, it was forced to release many prisoners, those who had finished their terms and those who were in prison for very simple unarmed activities.
On October the 24th, 1978, 1,126 political prisoners were released. Among them was Safar Qahramani, one who had been in different prisons for about 30 years. By releasing these prisoners, most of them on minor charges like reading forbidden books, the regime wanted to control public indignation. The newly released prisoners went to Behesht-e Zahra Cemetery to pay homage to those who lost their lives fighting for freedom. They said they owed their freedom to public support, not to the false benevolence of the regime. In January 1979, the Shah left Iran under the pretext of receiving medical treatment. Later, Imam Khomeini returned to Iran after 15 years of exile. His arrival gave the nation a new lease of life. Within a short space of time, the people took control of all military and strategic centers, including the Qasr prison, and released all political prisoners. A number of army top brass and Savak agents were arrested and put in the prison for a while. The first trials to investigate their crimes were held in the mosque of this prison. After the 1979 revolution, the Qasr prison was converted into an ordinary prison. But since it was located inside the residential district, in 2001 it was closed down forever. The municipality of Tehran then reconstructed the building and turned it into a museum. A museum that embodies the 200-year history of modern Iran.
During the time I was in the political department of the Garden Museum, I saw the youth we talked to change their opinions completely at the end of their visit. They couldn't believe that in Iran, under the Shah, such things existed. The society must be informed about it. The world must be informed about
it.
For me, these things must be etched on the walls of the Qasr prison. Here is the mirror reflecting the downfall of cruelty and corruption.
The Qasr Garden Museum in the heart of Tehran, a place that would once send shivers up and down spines, has now become a favorite haunt for people.
Most of the visitors who come here have a critical attitude, but when they're leaving here, they are overwhelmed and express their kindness to us. When it's explained for them, they realize what had happened here and who had to bear what harms and sufferings.
With its many programs and shows, the museum magnetizes a variety of visitors, from friends and families to school students and tourists.
In my opinion, the Qasr Garden Museum is a national place, and its programs must be national and distinguished, and even have a look at international programs. I believe that these bricks in this space are alive with the breaths of people. They must come and go if we want this place to be alive. When you enter Qasr Garden Museum, we see a pleasant place. That's due to the breaths of families who come here willingly.
A palace, a prison, and now a museum. A witness to the pain and grief of many people, this edifice has many stories to tell the children of this ancient land.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
Amid the rush of deportations, four detainees at two different ICE detention centers said that guards threatened to put them in COVID-19 wards, says John Washington Ryder in an article published under the heading, ICE threatened to expose asylum seekers to COVID-19 if they did not accept deportation. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Cameroonian asylum seekers locked up at the Pine Prairie ICE Processing Center in Louisiana say that a U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement guard threatened to expose them to COVID-19 if they failed to obey his orders and submit to a transfer. The guard made the threat clear. Clovis Fozal, one of the detained men, told The Intercept, if the detained migrants didn't submit, they would be transferred to Bravo Alpha, the detention unit where COVID-19 positive detainees are held in quarantine. They were forcing us out of the dorm, pushing and dragging us, Fozal said, explaining the alter action when the guards tried to force them to submit to the deportation. They threatened to call the SWAT team. They said they were going to put all of us into Bravo Alpha, which is for quarantine, where they keep everyone with the coronavirus. The Pine Prairie facility, which is operated by the private prison firm GEO Group, currently has 21 confirmed coronavirus cases, according to ICE's own tracker. After the threat of contagion, guards forcefully dragged and pushed a group of Cameroonian asylum seekers, 5 in total, yelling at them and repeatedly threatening them in an attempt to begin the deportation process. 3 of the detainees involved told The Intercept. In a statement, ICE said that it takes allegations of misconduct seriously and, when reported, will conduct investigations. Allegations of misconduct by ICE employees or contractors are reported to ICE's Office of Professional Responsibility, OPR, and are reviewed by the Department of Homeland Security, DHS Office of the Inspector General, OIG, and ICE officials said. ICE is firmly committed to the safety and welfare of all those in its custody. All 5 of the men had spent over a year in detention, said the 3 asylum seekers after fleeing Cameroon that has been targeting protesters supporting or even adjacent to the Anglophone separatist movement. In recent years, there have been massacres and mass atrocities in Cameroon, what some observers are calling a genocide, sparking increasing numbers to flee in search of safety. Nonetheless, the U.S. grant rate of asylum applications for Cameroonians plummeted over the last year, and as recently last November, Cameroonians were deported en masse. Some of the deported were detained and tortured upon arrival back in the country, according to returned asylum seekers reporters have spoken with. After the threats and the assault, Fozal and the others gave up and submitted to the transfer. What could we do, he said. There were so many more of them than us. The men said that they were crammed into a van with other detainees and taken to a staging center in Alexandria, Louisiana, where migrants are often grouped together before a deportation flight. There, they were again forced into overcrowded conditions where it was impossible to socially distance. There were about 100 people in one room, estimated one of the detainees who spoke with The Intercept on the condition of anonymity for fear of reprisal. After an affidavit submitted by a coalition of immigrant advocacy groups was delivered to the Department of Homeland Security Office of Inspector General, the deportation flight was canceled, as first reported by The Guardian. The letter lists a host of violent tactics ICE officials used to pressure the detainees to submit to their deportation, alleging that they engaged in torture. The threats of exposing detainees to COVID-19 are being reported here for the first time. ICE has the utmost confidence in the professionalism of the workforce and their adherence to agency policy, the ICE official said in the statement to The Intercept. However, ICE has decided to cancel a February 3rd flight to allow any potential victims or witnesses an opportunity to be interviewed, and will conduct an agency review of recent use of the force reports related to individuals on this flight, and issue any additional guidance or training as deemed necessary. Two days after taking office, President Joe Biden issued a 100-day deportation moratorium, one of his central campaign promises for immigration policy. The administration committed to review and reset enforcement policies as deportations were on temporary hold. 4 days after it was signed, a judge in Texas granted an injunction on a moratorium based on a lawsuit brought by the state of Texas. Though some expect the injunction to be lifted, ICE wasted no time in ramping back up to its deportation machine. As part of the same rush to continue deportations, Josiel Mendez, a Cuban asylum seeker being held in Etowah County Detention Center in Gadsden, Alabama, said that this week he and a group of other Cuban asylum seekers were also being threatened with exposure to COVID-19. If they didn't sign their deportation orders. Mendez told The Intercept that a ranking official at Etowah, who he called a captain, threatened to expose the group to the virus. "They were threatening to take us to the place where people go who have COVID," said Mendez, referring to the quarantine unit. Mendez himself had previously caught COVID-19 in Etowah, reporting symptoms including lasting shortness of breath, but said it was a relatively light case. He and other detainees balk at the threat. "I can't breathe, and they still don't listen to me," he said. Mendez described the medical conditions and the facility's response to the pandemic as abysmal. This week, he had asked for a new mask for losing his, Mendez said, and was told that they had none. The guard pointed to the empty box and said, "No masks." Mendez said he still struggled to catch his breath sometimes and was shocked at the treatment he and others received. Two of the men held in Pine Prairie who were threatened with COVID-19 exposure were especially vulnerable. Fazao has hypertension, and another of the detainees who requested anonymity for fear of retaliation said he had asthma. The asthmatic detainee told the guard he was at high risk for contracting COVID-19. "They don't care," he told The Intercept. Fazao, who has been detained for 18 months, said that some of the guards had claimed that the coronavirus is fake, it's not real. He added, "The way they manage COVID is very bad. I mean very, very bad." Both Pine Prairie and Etowah have come under fire for their dangerous mismanagement of COVID-19, with detainees in Etowah being punished for asking for a COVID-19 test. "They're going to put me in solitary confinement for this, for talking," Mendez told The Intercept. "But I want people to know, what are they going to do? Kill me? Maybe."
Inside Israel. The
social crisis in Israel has become big, so big that it's now a national security threat. This is according to the annual strategic assessment of Israel, published by the National Security Research Institute at Tel Aviv University.
Well, we're coordinating with the leaders of the different cities, and we're making sure that we're in close contact. But of course, we know there is a lot of tension due to the recent cabinet decisions, and a lot of people, especially in the religious cities such as, for example, Bnei Brak. As we saw yesterday, there were protests, and there are possibly protests that might take place also this evening. So that is something that we're definitely ready to deal with if necessary. But of course, the main aim will be to implement a full closure in all of the red zones, red cities.
The internal crisis in Israel now tops the third top post in the short list of national security threats facing Israel for the first time ever. In fact, it made the top list as the third most haunting issue for Israel, with Iran being on top place. This is the first time in Israel's history, apparently, that the social crisis there has been considered such a threat by the regime. It seems that things are only about to get worse there, too. According to the Institute, the internal crisis is represented by the instability of governance. The move to the fourth elections within 2 years would undermine the broad foundations of national security, the report added. The report also says that the crisis is a threat to Israel's national immunity. The report specifically cites the ongoing protests and the rise of violence and increase in bipartisan and divisions in Israeli politics that has reflected in society. The crisis, the report warns, will also lead to a weakening of regime agencies and institutions through difficulties in performance and obstruction of decision-making procedures. There is also a significant decrease in public confidence in institutions and the absence of solidarity and a common goal among the segments of Israeli society. The Institute believed that society is torn between health, economic, social, political, and governance crises simultaneously revealed during the corona epidemic. Keyword here, revealed. It turns out that these issues have always lingered in Israel, but were never addressed. The current crisis comes in light of the spread of the coronavirus as a result of the population's non-compliance with the instructions of the Ministry of Health and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. It also comes after some officials failed to adhere to instructions such as total closure on the population. And when officials did finally adhere to the regime's rules, health officials said it was too late.
The decline in trust in institutions has two reasons. One is a long-range effect, and one is the short term, which relates to the corona. The long term is the attack on institutions, mainly by Netanyahu, over the last few years. The courts, the attorney general, the police, etc. Recently, the people who work, the civil servants who work at the Ministry of Finance. So the gatekeepers. I mean, if you attack these people and these attacks, look what happened in America with Trump attacking the media. Everybody is leftist. Everybody is subversive. So you can see the results in the decline of trust, and in the short term relates to the corona. The management of the corona crisis is pretty poor, and just look at so many people, both on the ultra-Orthodox communities and the Arab communities, who just defy the orders of the government. So all in all, the long term and the short term have a strong impact on the decline of trust in institutions. I think the statement by the INSS that the internal divisions and feuds are a national security and actually a national crisis is correct. We can deal with any external threat. And we've shown over the decades that whenever we are attacked, we get together and we prevail. If we are divided like this and we lose trust in the institutions, and we are getting into the fourth elections in 2 years, no wonder people lose trust. And when they lose trust, this is very dangerous. So I agree, this is a great danger to Israel, the internal crisis, the internal feud. First of all, there's the old division between secular Jews or non-Orthodox Jews and ultra-Orthodox Jews in Israel. This has a long history of there's a community that pay less taxes, they don't study the core issues like math and English, etc., which are necessary to modern world. Many of the men don't work, and they don't serve in the army like all of us. I served, my children served, and my granddaughter now is in the army. So to look at a community that doesn't take part in the national effort is very infuriating. Come the corona, and you see these people defying the orders of the Ministry of Health, and they are getting infected. I think the Israelis would have accepted anything if they had leadership who would tell them, you know what? Everybody has now to pay something. People who can, people who make a lot of money should have paid, should have been taxed to help others survive this. But you need leadership for this.
On social media, the conversation took a different turn. On Twitter, Shimon says, an economic and social crisis in Israel. No services for welfare for 2 weeks. Leo says, Israel starting war to cover the economic and social crisis in Israel. Thousands of Israelis renewed weekly demonstrations against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, calling for the long-serving Prime Minister to resign over corruption charges against him and his alleged mishandling of the coronavirus crisis.
Public, it has no belief in its officials, in its government, in all the government offices. There's no belief in them, in none belief. The police is in force is using extra power on children, on elderly, on just people that are in the streets. On one hand, and on the other hand, other people do whatever they want. Nobody believes anybody anymore. So people don't trust anybody. They don't trust the opposition. They trust the government. And the thing is, why the people went down to the streets is because the disbelief. And what a lot of, not all of them, but a lot of people are saying, we do not want to go back to, it's in Hebrew, it's called the state, the old state, the old good state of Israel. We do not want to go there because it wasn't good for a lot of us. It wasn't good for the Palestinians. It wasn't good for the Mizrahim, it wasn't good for the Ethiopians, it wasn't good for a lot of people, basically. It wasn't good for the poor. So basically, I think people are saying, we want something that is completely new. We don't trust any of the politicians that are changing parties from, you know, they've been in this party and now they want to go in this party and now they're separating and they're combining. Most of the public does not believe the public figures in Israel almost anymore. There's no trust.
The effects of the political and economic crises and the strength of their negative effects largely stem from the way they were managed. Israelis blame the regime for the mismanagement of the coronavirus crisis. Opinion polls have recently showed the existence of a loss of confidence in the regime, Israel's leaders, and institutions. This loss of confidence has negatively affected the Israeli population's readiness to implement anything the regime tells it. Businesses, including restaurants, have failed to adhere to lockdown procedures. The poll also shows that most Israelis support the continuation of the demonstrations and protests. This even in the backdrop of their deteriorating economic and social conditions. This is, of course, a huge threat to the Israeli regime. The demands of the protesters have begun with the downfall of Netanyahu, but these protesters have went on to ask for the dissolution of the cabinet and Knesset and a fourth election. In December, their demands are met. Now, with a fourth election set for March, the weekly anti-regime protests still continue with more people joining. A recent survey by the Israel Democracy Institute showed that 83% of Israelis believe that there is no social solidarity there. According to this poll, 74% of Israelis say that they do not trust parliament, that is the Knesset, and cannot rely on it in the face of the pandemic. 70% do not trust the cabinet, 63% of them do not trust finance ministry officials, 51% of them do not trust the police, and 47% do not trust the Ministry of Health.
A statesman is not a politician. A statesman thinks about the future of the country, what's good for the country. The politician thinks about the next election, and what's good for him. And what we see today, we have politicians. We don't have the statesmen. We don't have the people who give us a vision. Just think about the Israelis today, they don't have hope. There's nobody they believe in who can speak to them and tell them the truth. If it's hard, Israelis know to go through hardships, but they need leaders, statesmen, to believe in. And we don't have these people right now. So let's see what happens in the next elections. I believe, I look at the protest, the hundreds of thousands of Israel taken to the streets, and there are some people who are doing it for week after week, you know, in the cold weather, rain or shine. And I know many of the young people who go to the process, and I see a lot of potential there. So I'm a sworn optimist, so I believe that we will see a new generation of people emerging out of this crisis and taking over. I think Israelis want a direction. Israelis are willing to go through a lot of hardships, but show us where we are going. If you look at the handling of the current corona crisis, the businesses are closing down. People are laid off. I don't know if they when the corona goes away, they will find any job anymore. And in the meantime, our leaders throwing money like from the helicopter on everybody, people who need it, people who don't need it, with no any plan of how we make a crisis into an opportunity. For example, strengthen the public health system. The reason why we survived this crisis is because we have Kupot Cholim, we have the health public health organizations, which are so strong and so accessible to the public. Look at the vaccination, how well it goes, because we have all those organizations which have been shrinking over the years because of lack of funds. And suddenly we have so much money to throw on everybody instead of investing in the public health system.
On social media, the conversation took a different turn. Sir Distick on Twitter says the commission found reasonable grounds to believe that individual members of the Israeli security forces, in the course of their response to the demonstrations, killed and injured civilians who were neither directly participating in hostilities nor posing an imminent threat. Yehi asks, what about the demonstrations against Bibi, the ones going on for months all through this pandemic? Jankowski says thousands of Israelis renewed their weekly demonstrations in occupied Jerusalem al-Quds against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, asking him to step down as Tel Aviv went into third COVID-19 lockdown. Since last year, Israel has been witnessing demonstrations everywhere.
It's a mistake to think that the public was out in the streets only to demand that the government will be dispersed. And it was a mistake, and there's also a mistake, a lot of people think that the demand is to interrogate all kinds of things, like the selling of the submarines or the buying of the submarines also to Egypt or to whoever. I'm not too involved in that issue. I think some of the public is out there saying we want a government that is not corrupt. But a lot of people are out in the streets, or a lot of people are not out in the streets, but basically they feel that they do not want to go back to business as usual. They do not want any government. And also, there's something I didn't mention, because on the last elections, one of the Kahol Levan party received a lot of voices. They received a lot of people voted for them, and the hope was that they would send Netanyahu to trial or to, you know, or home, basically. And they sold the public. They went into coalition with the Netanyahu government. So people don't trust anybody. They don't trust the opposition. They trust the government. People feel that the vaccinations, a lot of people are happy to take them, but a lot of people feel that the vaccinations, the fact that Israel has been receiving so many vaccinations, people feel that Israel is like the government is allowing people to be, the companies to do experiments on people here in Israel. So basically, the sense of disbelief is tremendous all over. And actually, when you look at what's happening around in Israel, you see the Palestinians for 48, talking Umm al-Fahim and cities within Israel. It's an uprising now. They're in the streets. There's police. Children of 14 years old are being arrested violently. You have these collisions with the Bnei Brak, with the Orthodox cities. You have it almost everywhere. Israel is extremely in unrest all around. There's nothing, you know, we've been out in the streets for 30 weeks now in Balfour in Jerusalem, but not only there. So basically, there's a big up. The society is in a situation of unrest, and also people feel that the fact that they're going to elections in the fourth time in 2 years, it's the feeling that there's no government, there's no head of police, there's all kinds of positions that are not occupied because Netanyahu is not, the government isn't functioning.
Israel has lost control of coronavirus for several reasons, the annual strategic assessment of Israel said, the most important of which is the loss of internal political stability and the failure of the Israelis to respond to the instructions of their regime. To this day, much of the Israeli public believes the coronavirus is a natural disaster, mainly due to their distrust of the regime. But it is important to know that these issues only shed light on underlying crises that have been ignored. Now, the social problem is a national and strategic security threat for Israel, one that has shaken the highest echelons of the regime. Here are the news making the press in Israel. Ynet News, cash-strapped public hospitals pull plug on emergency admissions. Six medical centers across Israel said that they will receive only COVID patients and those in life-threatening conditions over finance ministry failure to provide more assistance despite surge in new coronavirus cases. Some 200 doctors, nurses, and medical staff from seven public hospitals protested outside the finance ministry's offices in occupied Jerusalem, Al-Quds. Haaretz. Hundreds of members of the ultra-Orthodox community have protested in Beni Brak against police enforcement of coronavirus restrictions. A 41-year-old bus driver was hurt after being attacked with pepper spray by protesters, who proceeded to set the bus on fire. According to witnesses, the attackers shouted, "He's an Arab." Times of Israel. Clashes broke out in three cities across Israel as police attempted to enforce coronavirus lockdown restrictions in a number of ultra-Orthodox communities. In the occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds neighborhood of Mia Shirim, hundreds of people clashed with police attempting to shut down a yeshiva, a religious school that had opened illegally. The Jerusalem Post. A Swiss criminal court found Israeli businessman Benny Steinmetz guilty of corruption and sentenced him to 5 years in jail, delivering a landmark verdict in one of the mining world's most high-profile legal disputes.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 18, 2019 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, during a meeting with the people of East Azerbaijan. The meeting was held at Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya in commemoration of the anniversary of Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
The camp of the enemy, it was not just one enemy. The enemy was a camp, tried as hard as it could. It did whatever it could, from street fighting to ethnic conflicts to military coups to the eight-year imposed war to economic sanctions to starting the impressive machine of psychological warfare over the past 32 years. It is 32 years now that psychological warfare has been going on against the Iranian nation, against the revolution, and against the Imam. They lied, they leveled allegations, they spread rumors, they tried to foment discord, they tried to divert our people from their paths. The primary goal that they were pursuing was to crush the revolution and overthrow the Islamic Republic. The first goal was to overthrow the government. The next goal was to transform the revolution in case they fail in their attempt to overthrow the Islamic Republic. That is to say, the goal was to destroy the nature and the spirit of the revolution, but let it keep its surface form.
Allah, Allah.
They made a lot of efforts in this regard. The fitna of the year 1388, according to solar calendar, was the latest scenario that they planned out. In fact, it was another attempt. Some people inside the country fell for this plot because of their passions and the love for power and other such spiritual maladies which are caused by human passions. I have repeatedly pointed out that the designers and the masterminds were and still are outside our borders. Some people cooperated with them inside the country, some knowingly and some unknowingly. This was the second goal. The third goal that they have been pursuing is to make the Islamic Republic use weak and vulnerable elements who can be influenced. That is, if the Islamic Republic stays in power. They want to put such people in charge of the country's affairs and only deal with them.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah. Praises to Allah.
reporters.
The government of Venezuela is ramping up efforts to obtain coronavirus vaccines to inoculate its population, despite the ongoing economic crisis prompted by a series of tough U.S. sanctions. Although Venezuela has so far succeeded in keeping infections fairly low with regular lockdowns, the nation is still facing many challenges due to Washington's harsh restrictions. In this context, Venezuelan Foreign Minister Jorge Arreaza has slammed the rich countries in the Americas, namely the U.S. and Canada, for hoarding COVID-19 jabs. Arreaza remarked that this harmful policy is depriving other countries in the region of enough vaccines. He said this is a tantamount to putting political and commercial interests above human rights. Venezuelan officials back Arreaza's argument.
Venezuela will fight legally against the monopoly that the U.S. and its allies are purportedly trying to establish over COVID-19 vaccines.
However, some opposition members have a different opinion.
If the U.S. and Canada have more access to vaccines, it is because they are democratic countries and Venezuela is not.
But experts say that Venezuela is in fact a democratic nation and deserves free access to vaccines.
Venezuela has the same rights to the coronavirus shots as any other nation, since politics shouldn't meddle with humanitarian issues.
While the Maduro government works to guarantee a proper vaccination process for all the Venezuelans, it also has to deal with a round of U.S. sanctions that hinder the access to such vaccines in the region. Jesus Silva, Caracas.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have held a sit-in in front of the Red Cross office to support Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails and detention centers. The move comes as thousands of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to suffer from inhumane treatment and are being denied their basic rights, including access to proper medical care during the coronavirus pandemic. Last month, Israeli regime forces arrested 456 Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, including women and minors. Hamas movement demanded international protection for Palestinian prisoners.
Zionist practices against Palestinian prisoners violate all international laws and norms. We came here to express a united stance in solidarity with the prisoners. We call on all international organizations to intervene and protect Palestinian prisoners, especially during the coronavirus pandemic.
Currently, some 5,000 Palestinian political prisoners are being held in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers. The plight of Palestinian prisoners has increased amid the coronavirus pandemic. Around 400 of them have been infected with the deadly virus.
We call on the International Committee of the Red Cross to help Palestinian prisoners who continue to suffer inside Israeli jails. We are deeply concerned over the prisoners who suffer from medical negligence. More and more prisoners are infected with the coronavirus because of the overcrowding and lack of hygiene products.
Securing the release of prisoners is a highly emotive issue for Palestinians, who regard them as prisoners of war and as symbols of resistance against Israeli occupation.
Continuing the resistance is the key to liberate the prisoners, including by capturing Israeli soldiers to swap them with Palestinian inmates. We also need to increase solidarity activities to support the prisoners and highlight their suffering in Israeli prisons.
Solidarity with Palestinian prisoners has been a top priority for activists in Gaza, who say they are determined to stand by the prisoners for as long as it takes.
Latest statistics show that Israel has imprisoned nearly 1 million Palestinians since 1967. Currently, thousands of prisoners are kept inside Israeli jails, including